You are about to hear a story. Well, two stories, actually, that became intertwined. The first is a story of the 1930s Federal Theater Project, founded by the Works Progress Administration, its history and its activities according to its director, Hallie Flanagan. It is also, then, the story of the only fully government-sponsored theater America has ever had. The second is the story of the House Un-American Activities Committee in its first iteration, the Dies Committee. HUAC was founded to investigate everything from Nazis to KKK members, but soon focused all of its attention on artists, intellectuals, and communists. It became famous for this in the McCarthy era, but it started here with Hallie Flanagan.
I received a phone call from Harry Hopkins, chief aide to President Franklin Roosevelt, and an old friend from college, who asked me to come and meet with him in Washington.
When can you go to work?
Doing what, Mr. Hopkins?
Directing the Federal Theater Project. This is a tough job we're asking you to do. You don't think people from relief roles would necessarily be bad actors. You see no reason why we can't do some good plays with these people. Plays people want to see.
Any producer takes a gamble every time he opens a show.
People ride over roads and bridges built by relief workers, but will they ever come to a theater to see shows put on by relief workers?
They won't be relief workers after they start. They'll be theater workers again. People will come if the plays are good.
Draw up a plan.
In the days which followed, I studied the available records of unemployment in the theater profession. Because art in America has always been regarded as a luxury, artists in all fields had been the first to experience the Depression. As far as actors were concerned, they had suffered their own particular depression ever since 1914, when the Strand Theater, seating 3,000, opened on Broadway for exclusive showing of motion pictures. Sound films abolished the orchestra. Mechanical music displaced 30,000 musicians. Technological unemployment, while one great cause of the desperate situation in the theater, was no more serious than high admissions costs. The mass of people never have been able to afford theater going, and a great many other people who had previously regarded theater as recreation and education were forced to give it up. A lot of what the Federal Theater Project accomplished came out in the HUAC hearings, and all the newspapers and radio reporters were there. But it was largely ignored by the three congressmen on the committee. Joe Starnes, a Democrat from Alabama, also a lawyer and colonel, J. Parnell Thomas, a Republican from New Jersey, a businessman later indicted for corruption, and Martin Dies Jr., a Democrat from Texas, among the most vehement anti-communist of the 30s, and chairman of the committee at this time. Martin Dies opened the proceedings.
The chair wishes to reiterate what he has stated many times, namely that this committee is determined to conduct its investigation upon a dignified plane and to adopt and maintain throughout the course of the hearings a judicial attitude. The committee has no preconceived views of what the truth is respecting the subject matter of this inquiry. Its sole purpose is to discover the truth and report it as it is, with such recommendations, if any, as to legislation on these subjects, as the situation may require and as the duty of Congress to the American people may demand. We shall be fair and impartial at all times and treat every witness with fairness and courtesy. The chair wishes to emphasize that the committee is more concerned with facts than with opinions and with specific proof than with generalities. Opinions, conclusions, and generalities have no probative force in any court of justice, and they cannot be made the basis of any findings on the part of this committee. In investigating un-American activities, it must be borne in mind that because we do not agree with opinions or philosophies of others, does not make such opinions or philosophies un-American. The House Un-American Activities Committee will come to order. Will you please state what your position is, Mrs. Flanagan?
I am National Director of the Federal Theater Project under the Works Progress Administration.
How long have you held that position?
Since the inception of the project, Congressman Dyes, on August 29th, 1935.
Mrs. Flanagan, who appointed you as National Director?
I was appointed by Mr. Harry Hopkins.
Now, will you just tell us briefly the duties of your position?
Yes, Congressman Dyes. Since 1935, I have been concerned with combating un-American inactivity.
Inactivity?
I refer to the inactivity of professional people who, at that time when I took office, were on the relief rolls. And it was my job to expend the appropriation laid aside by congressional vote for the relief of the unemployed as it related to the field of the theater, and to set up projects wherever in any city 25 or more such professionals were found on the relief rolls.
What was the primary purpose of setting up this federal theater project?
To put back to work the unemployed professional people, rehabilitate them, and conserve their skills. That was then and always has been the prime purpose of the theater project. Now, if I may say so, the fact that we have returned to private industry some 2,000 people would seem to prove that we are considering that always as our major objective.
Now let us get into your background.
I was a professor of English at Vassar and in charge of the experimental theater.
You are the first woman in America to receive the Guggenheim Foundation scholarship, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. The three congressmen called a brief halt and huddled together, talking for a few minutes. My thoughts went back to that first meeting with Harry Hopkins.
Can you spend money?
Inability to spend money is not one of my faults.
It's not easy. It takes a lot of nerve to put your signature down on a piece of paper when it means the government of the United States is going to pay $1 million to the unemployed in Chicago. It takes decision, because you'll have to decide whether Chicago needs that money more than New York City or Los Angeles. You can't care very much what people are going to say, because when you're handling other people's money, whatever you do is always wrong.
You're very reassuring.
Whatever happens, you'll be wrong. Don't forget.
I spent a great deal of time in the New York office in those early weeks. It was there that I saw a man applying for work go mad, beating his head against the wall. He typified the desperation of the people with whom we dealt then. Meanwhile, we got to work. The secretary of the New York office, Evelyn Schrader.
Call Actors Equity immediately. Mr. Roberts has drawn up a radio plan. Can you see him today? Mr. Platt wants you to go to a stagehands meeting with him. Call the New York Times right away. And call Boston. Someone is interfering. A Negro delegation and says someone is discriminating again. Some man, Killingston, wants you to have lunch tomorrow on Sardi's. Oh, and the dancers are acting up again. Mr. Beck can't stand it.
It was in that New York office that the project began. Playwrights discussed scripts. Designers brought their sketches. The living newspapers, our trademark topical plays, dramatized current events. In an industry in which 50 is a fair-sized company and 500 colossal, we were trying to put 5,000 people back to work. The congressmen broke their huddle, lit cigars, and restarted the questioning.
You went abroad for 12 or 14 months to study the theater.
I did.
What date was that?
That was in 1926 and 1927.
You spent most of that time in which country?
In Russia.
In Russia? Was the statement true which was attributed to you in the New York Daily Times of September 22nd, 1935, or on about that time of your appointment, in which it was said that you said the Continental Theater was a tiresome and boresome matter, but Russian theater was a live and vital theater.
Congressman Starnes, that remark, if it is an exact quotation, is so casually given that I could not identify it. I have here in my brief a statement of the countries visited, of the records.
Well, how much time did you spend in Russia, Mrs. Flanagan?
I spent 2 months and a half in Russia, out of the 14 months. But let me say, gentlemen,
did you spend more time there studying the theater than you did in any other country?
I did. Because there are many more theaters in Russia than there are in any other country.
Did you or did you not make the statement that the theaters in Russia are more vital and important?
Yes, I did find that. And I think that opinion would be borne out by any dramatic critic that you cared to call to this chair.
What is it about the Russian theater that makes it more vital and important than the theaters of the continent and the theaters of the United States?
I have maintained consistently that we are starting an American theater, which must be founded on American principles, which has nothing to do with the Russian theater.
I know, but you are not answering the question, Mrs. Flanagan.
Well, I will go back and answer it. The Russians, if we are to go into this, are a very gifted people. They have had a long and an exciting history of theatrical development, and I found a great variety of Russian productions extremely interesting. For instance, I went to their ballet a great deal. They gave a beautiful ballet based on fairy tales.
All those fairy tales have a little moral to them, don't they? What we call a moral.
Not that I know of.
Well, I don't know whether it would be moral in Russia or not.
In the ballet, that is not true.
But we are talking about the theater. Let us stay with the theater.
In the theater, I saw a great many classics. And I saw a great many plays that advocated the Soviet form of government. That is quite true. I had been sent by the Guggenheim Foundation to make a comparative study of the tendencies of the theater.
That is not answering the question.
I think the witness ought to be allowed to finish her answer.
I think the witness's answer should be responsive to the question.
You are interrupting her all the time. I should like to hear what the witness has to say.
Go ahead.
The Guggenheim Foundation had sent me to make a study of the comparative tendencies in some 12 European countries in the course of a single year. In the course of that year, I went to England, Ireland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, to Latvia, Hungary, to Austria, to Germany, Italy, France, as well as to Russia. The record of that trip is embodied in a book called Shifting Scenes, and I have here the clippings from all over the world and from every leading paper in the United States on that book. And I can only say, gentlemen, and leave it to your own proof as you go over the testimony, that not one newspaper critic, when that book came out in 1927, not one critic picked out anything that was subversive or un-American. Would you like to have me read quotations from the press clippings?
No, because that is not responsive to the question.
But she was answering several questions, and you interrupted the witness when you didn't like the answer. I would like to hear what the answer is.
I would like to also, if it is responsive.
The correct procedure is that which is followed in court. The witness's testimony is supposed to be responsive, and then if the witness has any explanation to make, she may make it.
Part of the witness's statement was responsive, and part was absolutely not.
The witness makes her statement, and you don't let her finish it. You interrupt her, and I object to that.
Do you want me to continue with a discussion of the Russian theater?
No, I have some other questions, Mrs. Flanagan. Do you believe that the theater is a weapon?
Shall I discuss the American theater or talk about the Russian?
I refer to the theater generally. Do you believe that the theater is a weapon?
I believe that the theater is a great educational force. I think it is an entertainment. I think it is an excitement. I think it may be all things to all men.
The Russians use it as a means of teaching class consciousness, do they not?
I think they do.
Well, practically every play you saw was along those lines, was it not, Mrs. Flanagan?
Yes, I should say that that was the main theme of the Russian theater.
You make mention of the fact in your own book, Shifting Scenes. You say, quote, "The task of these actors, drawn from many provinces and fields of labor, is to build a theater which shall draw a vast audience, unaccustomed to theater-going." In the principles of communism, the struggle that Russia is making for a universal culture is bigger than anything you say about it. You must serve this thing bigger than itself, unquote. Now, what is this thing that you serve means, I don't know, unless it is training those people in communism who are not communists.
It has been years since I read that book myself, but I would accept your word if you say that it is in there. I think that is a very good account of what happened in Russia.
Well, this is on page 114, beginning with the second paragraph. Let me refer you to that article, and you see if I read it correctly.
Oh, no, Congressman Starnes, I don't see any need for that. I won't question it. I was just being facetious. I am rather honored by having it read.
Now, there is another statement that you have made here that some of the plays that were put out by the Federal Theater Project are propagandistic, or that breed class consciousness. Is that true or untrue?
Well, when we remember that these...
Well, not all of them, obviously, because of the testimony, is that 924 plays have been produced, and only 26, as I recall, were in question. Let us confine ourselves to those that are in question.
I do want to go into the matter of the 26 plays as much as this committee will allow me to do. But before I go into that, I would like to say that I could not say that we never did a propaganda play. But I should like to go to the actual definition of propaganda. Propaganda, after all, is education. It is education focused on certain things. For example, some of you gentlemen have doubtless seen One Third of a Nation, and I certainly would not sit here and say that that was not a propaganda play. I think in the discussion yesterday, the word propaganda was used in this connotation only, that any play which was propaganda was necessarily propaganda for communism. I should like to say very truthfully that, to the best of my knowledge, we have never done a play which was propaganda for communism, but we have done plays which were propaganda for democracy, propaganda for better housing...
I think you ought to develop that point right there. You said that some plays were propaganda for democracy. What do you mean by that? Propaganda for what forms of democracy and what particular things? Like housing, as you just mentioned?
Yes.
What others?
I would say... Shall we go into a discussion of democracy?
No, just name some of the things that the Federal Theater Project has put out propaganda plays for.
Yes. Well, let us say first, One Third of a Nation. In that, the definite propaganda was for better housing for American citizens.
Mm-hmm. What others?
I would say that, in general, Mr. Thomas, the Living Newspaper would be propaganda
for... But you are not answering the question. You mentioned housing?
Yes.
How about power?
Yes, I would say that power was propaganda for a better understanding of the derivation and the scientific meaning of power, and for its wide use in...
Was it for public ownership of power?
That portrayed, as effectively as possible, both sides of that controversy, and quoted both sides.
I want to tell you that this is a great show. It's fast and funny, it makes you laugh, and it makes you cry, and it makes you think. I don't know what more anyone could ask of a show. Now, let's get one thing clear. You will take a lot of criticism for this play. People will say it's propaganda. Well, I say what of it? It's propaganda to educate the consumer who's paying for power. It's about time someone had some propaganda for him. The big power companies have spent millions on propaganda for the utilities. It's about time the consumer had a mouthpiece.
Dividends rise. Stockholders are happy and electric consumption increases. But where is the person who uses it? Where is the consumer? Let's have a look at her. Ah, there she is. What do you pay for electricity, ma'am?
Too much. 17 cents a kilowatt hour.
The company that services you is only making a fair profit.
What do they do with all that money?
It goes back to the stockholders in dividends.
I'm going to stop in at the company. I'll tell those people something. 17 cents a kilowatt hour. How much are you charging me for electricity?
17 cents a kilowatt hour.
Too high. I'll go someplace else. Where's the other fellow?
There is no other fellow.
You're the only one selling electricity in the city.
That's right. Would you like us to discontinue service?
No. never mind.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is power.
How about injunction granted?
Injunction granted is propaganda for fair labor relations and for fairness to labor in the courts.
In other words, it does teach class consciousness, doesn't it?
I am trying to give you my definition of propaganda and just what it teaches.
Yes. Well, that is what this play teaches, isn't it?
I was trying to explain more clearly and more definitively what I mean by propaganda.
Yes, but the play Injunction Granted was an attack against our present system of courts, wasn't it?
No, I should say that that play was a historical study of the history of labor in the courts.
Well, I know, but don't you believe that it does attack the present system of courts?
I do not believe that it fosters class hatred. No, I do not believe so.
How many people are engaged in these federal theater projects in New York?
Over 4,000.
Out of how many altogether?
Out of a total of some 9,000 throughout the United States.
You recently made a report of your activities, and you gave the number of people you estimated you have now played to since the establishment of the project. How many people do you figure you had as audiences in the United States for these plays?
The recorded figure, Congressman Dies, was something like 25 million people.
In other words, you have reached approximately 25% of our population with your plays?
Something like that. One of the greatest problems, if you will permit me to speak for just a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the greatest problems is that while in the other art projects it is possible to establish them in every state of the Union, which we would also like to do here, it is not possible with us. Because while an artist can paint or a musician play or a writer write, if there is no audience or only one or two people involved, we cannot set up theaters except in states where there are 25 or more people of satisfactory type on the relief rolls. So that one of our problems is this centralization of the theater industry.
Where have your audiences been? What localities have you played mostly?
We have played, I think I am safe in saying, the widest variety of American audiences that any theater has ever played.
In what localities, Mrs. Flanagan?
The chief localities are first New York City and next Los Angeles and Chicago, because that is where the greatest unemployment exists. They are the three largest cities. But if you are speaking now of the audiences themselves, I want to pick up on that point, if you don't mind.
I merely want to know the places where you have played, but if you want to discuss audiences, it is all right.
I do want to discuss them, because that allegation was made here by one of your witnesses, which I would not like to remain in the minds of any of you around this table. My impression is that you are trying to get at all the facts.
That is correct. And if this statement is untrue, we want you to refute it.
I want to quote from her allegation. Miss Huffman says, "They couldn't get any audiences for anything except communistic plays." Now, gentlemen, I have here proof that that is an absolutely false statement. We have, as sponsoring bodies for the Federal Theater, lists of organizations covering 20 pages of this brief, which I intend to write into the record, and I will summarize them for you. 263 social clubs and organizations, 264 welfare and civil organizations, 271 educational organizations, 95 religious organizations, 91 organizations from business industries, 16 mass organizations, 66 trade unions, 62 professional unions, and 15 political organizations. Note, gentlemen, that every religious shade is covered and every political affiliation and every type of educational and civic body in the support of our theater. It is the widest and most American base that any theater has ever built upon, and I request you not only to write that into the record, but to read the list of public schools and universities and churches and the civic and social groups that are supporting this federal theater. The Federal Theater Project was not only in New York City. For instance, It Can't Happen Here, adapted by Mr. Sinclair Lewis from his novel, opened simultaneously in 21 theaters and 17 states. Though not without struggle. Mr. Lewis?
I haven't slept all night. For the matter of that, as you know, I haven't slept for weeks. Now it is all terrible.
What has happened?
We need to revise Act 3. The new ending doesn't make sense, and the scenery looks like a cheap boarding house. It is all a failure.
Go to bed, Sinclair. For the first time, professional theater was considered regionally.
In North Carolina, directors set up new lines of activity for community groups. In a West Virginia coal camp, coal diggers wrote and performed plays about themselves. In Gary, we founded a children's theater for the children of steelworkers. We ran a theater for the blind in Oklahoma.
It was the beginning of a dramatic renaissance. From the letter of a young actor in upstate New York, Erford Gage, to the Federal Theater Project. I came not as a beginner in the theater, but as a somewhat seasoned trooper, after working stock for 6 years or so, and therefore I fully appreciate what Federal Theater has done for me. I have had the privilege of working in finished productions and being directed by established men. I know hundreds of young people like myself do appreciate the chance we have been given, in a field which has been almost closed to us in these years, to earn a living doing what we want to do. Sinclair?
Hallie, it's all over. I'm sorry, but it's all over. I made that play out of my life's blood, and you know it's the only good play that the Federal Theater ever did.
Oh, well, I don't...
And now you close it!
Sinclair, we're not closing the play, just moving it to another house. I thought you agreed to all this when we...
I don't think I'm asking much for all I've done for Federal Theater. You said yourself I had done more for Federal Theater than any living person.
Did I say that?
I think so. Anyway... I am through now. There is nothing you can do.
But Mr. Lewis soon relented. It Can't Happen Here played in English, Yiddish, and Spanish for the equivalent of 5 years.
Now, I want to quote finally from your article, A Theater is Born, on page 915 of the Theater Arts Monthly edition of November 1931. Quote, "The power of these theaters springing up everywhere throughout the country lies in the fact that they know what they want. This is important because there are only two theaters in the country today that are clear as to aim. One is the commercial theater, which wants to make money. The other is the workers' theater, which wants to make a new social order. Unlike any art form existing in America today, the workers' theater intends to shape the life of this country socially, politically, and industrially. They intend to remake a social structure without the help of money. And this ambition alone invests their undertaking with a certain Marlowe-esque madness," unquote. Now, you are quoting from this Marlowe. Is he a communist?
Oh, I'm very sorry. I was quoting from Christopher Marlowe.
Well, tell us who Marlowe is.
Put in the record that he was the greatest dramatist in the period immediately preceding Shakespeare.
Oh, of course. We had what some people call communists back in the days of the Greek theater.
Quite true.
And I believe that Mr. Euripides was guilty of teaching class consciousness also, wasn't he?
I believe that was alleged against all of the Greek dramatists.
So we cannot say when it began.
Wasn't it alleged also of Ibsen and against practically every great dramatist?
You think it is entirely proper that the Federal Theater produced plays for the purpose of bringing out some social idea that is a heated issue at a particular time?
It is one of the things that the theater can do.
One of the important things. You said earlier you did not believe in producing any play that has any vulgarity in it or profanity or anything of that sort. Didn't you say that?
I did not mention profanity. I did say a play which was vulgar.
Do you think it is proper that the taxpayers' money of America should be used to produce a play to an American audience that contains vulgarity and profanity? I am not undertaken to indict you or anything you have done. I'm just getting your idea as to whether you think that is a proper thing to do.
I have no defense for blasphemy.
I know you have not. Do you think it is proper that the Federal Theater should produce a play in which vulgarity and profanity appears throughout, as it does in Stevedore?
No, I do not.
Then you will agree with me that the play should not have been produced.
I think we should look into the matter.
Do you not also think that since the Federal Theater Project is an agency of the government, and that all of our people support it through their tax money, people of different classes, different races, different religions, some who are workers, some who are businessmen, don't you think that no play should ever be produced which undertakes to portray the interests of one class to the disadvantage of another class? Even though that might be accurate, even though factually there may be justification normally for that, yet because of the very fact that we are using taxpayers' money to produce plays, do you not think it is questionable whether it is right to produce plays that are biased in favor of one class against another?
I think we strive for objectivity, but I think the whole history of the theater would indicate that any dramatist holds a passionate brief for the things he is saying.
I'm talking about plays that you are authorized as a representative of the American people to supervise, plays that all of us help to finance, people of different conditions and different opinions. Now, do you think it proper that a play be produced which represents the desires and the viewpoint of one class to the disadvantage of another class?
I think that if every play that you did expressed one class opinion, that it would be a loaded theater and quite out of keeping with a theater subsidized by government funds. However, I think you would have to take into consideration the many plays done, the many types of plays. I think that you gentlemen would have to go to some of the plays.
I'm not arguing with you, I'm just asking you. You are the source of our information. We are not asking this in any sarcastic manner.
Yes.
This is for the purpose of eliciting information from you, who are the servant of our administration in this important matter.
Quite true.
And to you we come for the information.
Yes.
So I'm asking you if you do not think you are treading upon dangerous ground when you use an agency of the government, no matter how laudable it may be in private life, but when you use the agency to portray the interests or the arguments of the Workers' Alliance or the CIO or any other class or group, so that by subtle portrayal you paint that group or you paint the other class in a disadvantageous role, don't you think that is more or less dangerous?
We are not doing plays to stir up class hatred. Was the Dies Committee afraid because we were educating people? Or because our plays made for a better understanding between classes and races? Art in America had hitherto been apart from politics, but these projects were at the core of life. If they were mixed up with politics, it was because life in our country is mixed up with politics. Our playwrights and playgoers cared about economic and social plays. All such plays focused on a struggle hitherto infrequently stressed in the drama of our country. The struggle of many different kinds of people to understand the natural, social, and economic forces around them, and to achieve, through these forces, a better life for more people.
Is it not a fact that when you do produce a play that gives all the breaks to one class, such as the Workers' Alliance, or such as the CIO, or such as the workers of the country generally, gives them breaks over another class, over the employers or the business people, would you not join with me in condemning that as a dangerous policy?
Could you give me a specific example?
I am asking you if that is done. I am not assuming it is done.
We do not do plays that stir up class hatred. If you can give quotations, I will be glad to answer.
Can you give me a single play, not among the group now dealing with historical plays or things of that sort, but among the 10% that you say deal with social and economic questions? Can you submit to this committee one play that does not convey a subtle impression throughout, so that when the audience is left with the play, the Workers' Alliance or the CIO or Organized Labor does not have the best of the other fellows?
My congressman dies. I could sit in this room until the end of the day and give you such plays. Spirochete, for example.
What is that?
It is a living newspaper of the study of syphilis, which was backed by the Surgeon General of the United States.
I am not talking about that.
And by all the health departments. That is one of the plays that comes in the category you have just mentioned.
All right.
It is one of the plays in the 10%. It is definite propaganda for education in regard to social diseases.
All right.
And as I say, it is backed and sponsored by the medical associations of this country. That is a perfectly clear example, isn't it? Another
one. What others?
Another one is a living newspaper on flood control. Another one is on Bonneville Dam, in which the whole thing is a history of the development of Bonneville Dam.
Showing the necessity for it?
Yes, to some extent.
And the great value of it?
To some extent. Showing also the great heroism of it, and the scientific knowledge necessary to put it through. Many of our plays deal with the pressing situations around us, some of them springing from unemployment, but without the slightest attempt to stir up class hatred.
Do you agree, then, with the proposition that no play should be presented that will give advantage to one class over another class where there is controversy involved?
I do not think you can possibly take that position. I think that there again I would have to go back to my original premise that I want a good play, a powerful play, preferably of native material, and that in at least 10% of the cases, I would feel we should do a play that had something to do with modern life.
Then this federal theater is a very powerful vehicle of expression, isn't it? And of propaganda, because as you say, it reaches 25 million people. It therefore can be used or abused.
Yes.
With serious consequences, can it not?
Yes, sir.
And do you know of any way in which it could be more seriously abused than it would be to portray, as I said a few moments ago, one class putting them at an advantage over another class?
I have been giving a long list of illustrations of the fact that we do not do so.
I'm not asking you that. I say, isn't that a fact?
I am asking you for illustrations where we have done that. I claim you are stating a hypothetical case, Congressman Dyes.
Then, will you say that you have not produced a play in which one class of workers is not portrayed in an advantageous role?
First, you asked me if I could give you a single play in which we have not done that.
You gave that.
I say I can show you a myriad. So I would not take the position you have said. That is too strong a position. For instance, in Power, the central character is the consumer. And the whole play shows that all of us, as consumers of power, have some question as to how it came into being, and what makes it, and what is the best possible use of it.
What is the objective of the play? What impression is it designed to bring in the mind of the audience, the play Power? That public ownership is a good thing?
I think the first thing the play does is to make you understand more about power. Where it comes from, and how it has evolved, about its whole historical use.
All right.
I think it also does speak highly for the public ownership of power.
Let us just take that one instance. We will assume, for the sake of argument, that maybe the public ownership of power is a desirable thing. Do you not think it improper that the Federal Theater, using the taxpayers' money, should present a play which champions one side of the controversy?
No, Congressman Dyes, I do not consider it improper. I have just said that I felt that in a small percentage of our plays, and pointed out that it is a 10% that do hold a brief for a certain clause in accord with general forward-looking tendencies, and I say that
who
in
is
this...
to determine what is a forward-looking tendency?
Why, our play policy board chooses these plays.
They are to determine that question as to what is a forward-looking tendency? They, therefore, would have the idea that public ownership of utilities was a forward-looking tendency.
Also with the idea, Congressman Dyes, that first, the play must be good. It must have the power to hold the audience.
I am assuming that. But we are confining ourselves to the proposition, take power. You say that your policy board must first pass on this. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Then your policy board approves the public ownership of utilities. Then you think that because they approve the principle of public ownership of utilities, it is proper that the Federal Theater shall exhibit a play in which it champions the right of public ownership, do you not?
I do think so.
All right. Now, would the same thing be true with reference to the public ownership of railroads, because the policy board...
I do not know. We never choose plays that way, Congressman Dyes.
I understand that, but assume that a play is submitted to you that champions the cause of public ownership of railroads, and the majority of the policy board say, we are in favor of public ownership of railroads. Then you would believe it right to exhibit that play to 25 million people?
That is the very grave responsibility, Congressman Dyes, with which I am charged.
Do you think it would be right to show that play under those circumstances?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think that type of play should be done?
I think that is entirely too hypothetical a question, Congressman Dyes.
Having accepted one principle, the principle that you have the right to exhibit a play championing the public ownership of utilities, how could you draw the line?
Each play draws its own line. Each play makes its own contribution and has its own question.
But having established that precedent of public ownership of utilities, how could you stop where plays are presented to your policy board, dealing with the ownership of railroads, dealing with the ownership of land and other matters? Would it not be the same principle involved?
I told you over and over again that the basic principle is it a good play?
You have established the precedent of exhibiting a play championing the cause of ownership of public utilities. You said that was proper, and you yourself thought you had a right to do that.
I think so.
What would keep you or the policy board from continuing that same type of plays so as to cover other ranges of public ownership?
If someone came up with a very good play, proving that the private ownership of railroads was the best possible thing, and the play was a good play, we would do it.
Then, on the other hand, if the play proved that the public ownership of railroads was a good thing, you would do it too, would you not?
Absolutely. The test is it a good play within the general range we have established?
And if someone came with a play showing the public ownership of all property in the United States, and it was a good play, you would also exhibit that, would you not?
Well, that is a very clever move on your part to maneuver me into a certain position.
I do not pretend to any cleverness. I would not undertake to match my cleverness with you on this subject because you are thoroughly acquainted with it.
No, I would not. We would stop with that because that would be recommending the overthrow of the United States government. And I do not want that, gentlemen, whatever some of the witnesses may have intimated.
In other words, you would favor doing it by degrees, but not all at once. Isn't that right? What time is it, please?
1:15.
We will adjourn for 1 hour.
Just a minute, gentlemen. Do I understand that this concludes my testimony?
We will see about it after lunch.
I would like to make a final statement, if I may, Congressman Dyes.
We will see about it after lunch.
We never saw about it after lunch.
You don't look like a communist.
If your committee isn't convinced that neither I nor the FTP is communistic, I want to come back this afternoon.
We don't want you back. You're a tough witness, and we're all worn out.
I was called to testify 2 more times before Congress, before the money for the Federal Theater was distributed to other projects.
Several witnesses brought us evidence of communist domination in the WPA's Federal Theater Project. Our evidence was so complete that the predominantly liberal Congress abolished both projects.
The Federal Theater was ended permanently by act of Congress on June 30th, 1939.
When I heard the news, I went to the office and called Washington. Mr. Morris was out of town. Mrs. Carroll was out of town. Mr. Hopkins' voice was indistinct and far away. Is it true?
Yes.
What was the reason given in the report?
No reason was given.
What was the evidence cited?
No evidence was cited.
Who's in charge of the fight to save Federal Theater?
There isn't going to be a fight for the Federal Theater.
What became of the people? Many of those who had been directing went back to jobs in commercial theaters or onto jobs in cinema, in radio, in television. Some won fellowships from universities and foundations. Individuals able to find private employment were, of course, the exception. Our people were told in place after place that instructions from Washington made it impossible to give them employment. Many returned to home relief roles or to destitution. A telephone call came in from a congressman. I expected condolence, but that was not the intent. He wanted to talk about the theater project in his state. But, Congressman Starnes, there is no federal theater. You voted it out of existence.
What?
It was abolished on June 30th by act of Congress.
Was that the federal theater?
Our whole emphasis in the theater enterprises which we are about to undertake should be on rethinking rather than on remembering. The good old days may have been very good days indeed, but they are gone. New days are upon us, and the plays that we do and the ways that we do them should be informed by our consciousness of the art and economics of 1935. We live in a changing world. Man is whispering through space, soaring to the stars and ships, flinging miles of steel and glass into the air. Shall the theater continue to huddle in the confines of a painted box set? The stage must experiment with ideas, with the psychological relationship of men and women, with speech and rhythm forms, with dance and movement, with color and light, or it must and should become a museum product. In an age of terrific implications as to wealth and poverty, as to the function of government, as to peace and war, as to the relation of the artist to all these forces, the theater must grow up. The theater must become conscious of the implications of the changing social order, or the changing social order will ignore, and rightly, the implications of the theater.